All right, after a comically long trial in the nets, he's now the newly minted CEO of Cricket Australia. He's got no My Cricket stats, to my knowledge, that I can deduce, but he played juniors at Oxford University before going on to clubs like PwC, the London Olympics, the Cricket World Cup, the ICC, and now Cricket Australia. Like two predecessors before him, he's courageously opted to submit himself to the Grade Cricketer podcast, which will undoubtedly be the toughest interview he'll have done this morning.
Yeah.
Nick Hockley, welcome to the Grade Cricketer.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Nick, congratulations on the role. I'll start with the question that everyone wants to know and will be most important to your chances of success in the role. James Sutherland and Kevin Roberts played first-class cricket, but I can't find any Crick Info bio for you. If you didn't face aggressive Australian cricketers in the 90s, can the public be expected to trust you? And moreover, what is your playing relationship to cricket?
Cricket was my first love, and I made it through to the mighty heights of Warwickshire under-13s.
Yeah,
nice.
The highlight of this week has been, actually, I got a message on LinkedIn from Richard Cox, who was the academy director at Warwickshire, and he said, handy medium pacer who nipped it around a bit, which I thought that was actually, I'll take that. But no, my dad played for Middlesex Young Amateurs, so cricket was in our household. We shared a back fence with Dennis Amos, so I played my club cricket for a club called West Bromwich Dartmouth in the Birmingham League. Up through until 16. Mm. And I suppose what happened for me was, a lot of the players that I played with went on, had very successful county careers, the likes of Mark Waugh without a U Anurag Singh. And, I found that everyone was just getting quicker and quicker. And then one season when I was about 16, 17, I got called a bit for having a slightly suspect action, and from then I really focused in on rugby as the game that I played to a decent level. But then, so played for England at student level at rugby, but still played a lot of club cricket, a lot of social cricket. So cricket was my first love, and I've spent the last 9 years working on Australian cricket and loved every single minute of it.
Unbelievable. The new CEO of Cricket Australia chucked it.
That's got a call for chugging.
Unbelievable. I mean, yeah, I know that you're a well-accomplished rugby player, Nick. I mean, like, how good are we talking? Are we talking semi-pro, bit of rep stuff, club stuff? Like, what are we looking at here?
Yeah, well, it's probably the reason I ended up in Australia. I live with three Aussies at uni, and I played my club rugby for Moseley.
Yeah.
So that's that was second division at the time. Played that just when it went semi-pro, or just when it went pro, 95, 96. I wouldn't say I was full-time professional, but the first year of my career, played in the second division. And as I said, I played for England at student level, but had to make the decision whether I wanted to go full-time or whether I wanted to concentrate on my career. And I reckon I maxed out of my potential. But I did get to play in front of a full house at Twickenham in front of 75,000. So really lived up. That was a childhood dream of mine.
I bet it was. Yeah. How did that happen? How did you play in front of 75,000?
So that was in the university game, Oxford versus Cambridge. So.
Right.
Again, as I said, lived with three Aussies at the time. We had a load of Aussies playing in that match, who became great mates, and which is why I came out to Australia and eventually ended up here.
Yeah, yeah.
Sydney Uni versus UTS in the cricket here doesn't get as many people. So Nick, speaking of being in Sydney, we invited you into the studio here in Melbourne, but you're in Sydney, and we were actually stirred by that as ex-Sydney guys. Is it true now that, like, can we say now that the balance of power is in cricket is moving back to cricket's most supreme state? Now it's helmed by a rugby man, so presumably you don't worship at the altar of AFL, which will be very stirring for a lot of other people as well, and very upsetting for many down here, but... why was it Sydney for you? Was it love?
Well, my wife's from Sydney, and when we moved back from London over to start, I started work on the Cricket World Cup, and we started out in Melbourne. I just found there's just been loads of travel with these jobs, and my wife's, all her family are here, and what's worked out over time is living in Sydney, but then commuting down to Melbourne. I really get the best of both worlds, and if you think about all our partners, our broadcasters, the cricketing media, aside from yourselves, there's a good number of people in both markets, and so it just seems to have worked well that we've got a system. And this is really a national role, and a lot of travel around the country and in normal times internationally. So it makes sense to have our support network close by. But as the guys will tell you down at Cricket Australia, I'm typically down there when we can travel. I'm down there at least 3 days a week.
Okay, but obviously the water's nicer in Sydney. And the other thing that I've gleaned, because we do a lot of research into these interviews, and it might surprise you, is that the other reason Sydney might appeal to you is because my understanding is you actually met your wife at Mansions. In King's Cross. So would you...
Well, you've done your research well.
One of the great circuits.
Fingers a lot of pies, Nick. Fingers a lot of pies. And CCTV footage. But what are your recollections of Mansions back in the day?
I got a few.
Oh, goodness. Well, it's true. I did meet Lauren at Mansions. And I was basically wingman for a great mate of mine, Grant, who we played rugby together. And he said, I've met this girl. I need a wingman. And it was a Sunday night. And those Sunday nights where you've just got an absolute... Oh. You got a lot to do the next morning. I said, and a lot of work to do the next day. I said, Grant, no, mate, do I really have to come? And anyway, he just goes, mate, I really like this girl. Well, he's ended up marrying Hannah. And there was nowhere else open. So we ended up at Mansions. And met Lauren, and the rest, as they say, is history. Yeah.
Perfect. I took to myself back to some of the great
times.
Yeah,
that's right. You just blacked out a little bit there. Yeah. Nick, just onto, I suppose, administrative matters or cricketing matters. Like, when it comes to the sporting stage with the glitz, the glamour, players, commentators, like, I don't know about other countries, but I know here, sports administrators are, like, hardly looked upon as rock stars, and that can sometimes be viewed with the same kind of skepticism as politicians, or that's reserved for politicians. Like, with that in mind, can administrators ever be popular, and does that matter to you?
I mean, what matters to me is doing a really good job and doing everything we can to grow the sport and make a contribution to the community. But what I do find interesting in Australia, as compared to probably to the UK, there's just so much interest in the business of sport. And I think it's great because it holds everyone to account. It shows how much people care about the sport. But my view is, and will be that, the stars of the show, the cricketers, and our job is to, put in place the very best conditions to everyone to succeed. But equally, we need to front up. If there are issues, we really need to front up. So the I'm not one to necessarily seek the limelight or the kind of the public attention. For me, it's about doing an amazing job of growing the sport, delivering incredible experiences, and I'll continue to do that.
In terms of grade cricket, Nick, I mean, our feeling was when we were sort of the end of our playing days here was that there was a gradual separation over the last sort of 20 years between, the grassroots grade cricket and the Australian men's team, because there was such an intricate link previously, during the most, the sort of strongest era of Australian cricket, especially there was this really tight link between grade cricket and the international team. And then that sort of slowly dissipated and slowly separated. And I sort of wonder now there's no doubt there would have been huge lost revenues for every sporting organisation, not just Cricket Australia, but I imagine that'd be the case for you guys right now. But there's still all these people and clubs like struggling to survive really during COVID, you know. So what I'm asking, I suppose, is, you know, even though there's this sort of rebuilding phase for CEA and trying to get those revenues and trying to keep the game building and stuff, can clubs around the country still rely on CEA for the grants and just to keep the, you know, just to keep the game alive in these sort of, you know, each individual community?
Yeah, I think the cricketing ecosystem, I mean, it's really complicated, it's intricate, it's interlinked, it's actually kind of really finely balanced, but it is all very much, it's very much interlinked. And, you know, I see the elite game, it's about providing inspiration to encourage more people to come into the game at a community level, but equally the elite game is about, it's really about creating as much value as possible so that we can then reinvest it in the community. Mm. In this role, I'm very focused on making sure that we operate in a global entertainment business. It's a really sophisticated, very competitive business. And, you know, part of the job is to make sure that is as commercially successful as possible so that we can actually then reinvest and invest in growing the game at a community level. So certainly I think that's a really fundamental purpose of the elite level game. Mm. And yeah, I mean, we talked a bit about rugby earlier. I mean, I think they're doing a good job, but that's something of a cautionary tale that if we don't invest in the grassroots and growing the game, then what can happen?
Yeah.
At that top end of the spectrum there, Nick, just going to fire some maths at you here. Australia has 26 million people. India has 1.5 billion people, apparently. Australians are not satisfied unless every one of our teams are dominant superpowers at all costs and all times. And yet India will soon have 5 teams that can probably do that. What are you going to do to ensure we become the greatest again, even though it would appear mathematically impossible to compete with India now and into the future in what we're calling, as well as Kevin Rudd is calling, the Asian century?
Well, I think we've proven that we have been the best. We can be the best. I think we've been a major exporter of the best coaches, the best talent, the best players. I mean, you know, you look at any metric. You look at the IPL auction. You look at the number of coaches, support staff in the IPL. So actually, India are looking to us for a lot of support. But I think there's no silver bullet. It's making sure the system is as effective as possible at every single level, all the way through. And I think it's fantastic that the Australian public demands nothing less than the best in the world.
Mm. When you sort of go into meetings, Nick, with like governments and organising tours and that sort of thing, who's the alpha in the room when you're walking in? Do the governments like, you know what, we just want the Cricket Australia money, come and, you know, bring the circus to town, play the games, people spend the money, especially during COVID times, I'd imagine? Or do you have to do some convincing? You know, when you walk into those big meetings with the governments trying to get those games going, who's the big swinging dick in town?
Yeah. So I'll tell you what, I reckon it's the game itself. And what's been incredible through COVID is that people just want to help and they want to see it succeed, because people absolutely love our national sport. So for me, going into those meetings, when, you know, whether it's getting international touring sides into the country, whether it's, you know, playing, you know, if I needing to find a home for particular matches that we've had to move at really last minute, getting contingencies on standby, any of those things, it's I mean, literally you have to pick up the phone and people want to go, how can we help? And that's a very humbling thing in this position. But I think it all boils down to the fact that cricket's place in the community and people can see the value. So I wouldn't say there's, you know, an alpha. I think there's probably quite a few alphas all sitting around seeing how we can, you know, make it as successful as we possibly can. But I've found it in my time, you know, just the support we've had from governments all around the country has just been absolutely phenomenal.
How important is it to be able to be alpha as a CEO? You know, what's your sort of alpha level? Alpha. Do you have a brand of, there's different brands of alphadom out there, you know, like how would people describe Nick Hockley's sense of alphadom. Some people reject the premise altogether, you know. What's your relationship to alpha life?
Well, I think I describe my leadership style as quite an inclusive style of leadership and wanting to hear everyone's opinions and, you know, no, there's no monopoly on good ideas. You know, where I probably get alpha is if kind of wheels are spinning, we're not making forward progress, and then I'll make a call and we move forward. But my starting premise is to try and get everyone on the same page.
Like it. On that note, Nick, speaking of like wheels spinning or high powered meetings, I was going to ask you an important question. And it's one that we've asked our predecessors as well, James Sutherland and Kevin Roberts. I'm going to ask it word for word how we ask them, because it is the question that best captures the state of playing cricket. Do you get champed by the BCCI?
Oh, I'll tell you what, my relationship with the BCCI, I think, has been quite unique to COVID.
Yeah.
You know, normally, as I'm informed, there's kind of, you know, there's formal letters and, you know, there might be a week or two or even maybe more goes by with the exchange of correspondence. We've literally been on Zoom 3 times a day for 12 months. And now, you know, it all happens on WhatsApp. So, you know, I think this period, we've all had to work so much closer together. We've all got to know each other very well. And, yeah, I'll tell you what, I really feel for them at the moment. My goodness, with the postponement of the IPL, I mean, everyone we speak to has got lost friends and family. It's just pretty devastating what's going over there. So I'll tell you what, we're just really thinking of all our mates over there at the moment. And I have to say, they've just been brilliant. They were brilliant in the fact they came over here, they quarantined. They were brilliant and they got all our players back from the IPL. So I have to say, they've just actually been brilliant to deal with.
How's the relationship with Sourav Ganguly? Like when you message him on WhatsApp, you know, are you addressing him as Dada? Does he make you call you know, Mr. Ganguly? Does he recite his stats for test matches and ODI records? I mean, what's the relationship there?
He's just really great. He's a good down-to-earth guy, and he's Sourav. Mm. And I'll tell you what, there's no one that's more passionate about the game, cares more about the game, and he's just, again, he's been an absolute pleasure to deal with. Yeah, really excited. I mean, Dean, been dealing with him recently because we've got the Indian women's team coming out here for a test match.
Of course, yeah.
And yeah, I know they're really excited about it. That's a big moment. Big moment for them. But yeah, as I say, look, I found them to be, you know, they're very relatable, very human, and we've all worked together. And I think everyone at the moment around the world understands that we've got to keep cricket going, because that's the lifeblood. If we don't keep cricket going, then you know, the financial ramifications are very, very significant for everybody.
Closer to home, Nick, speaking of Dada type characters, Peter Vlandis is a CEO contemporary of yours. He's a CEO of Rugby League for our global audience of the NRL. Speaking of alphas, he recently detailed his approach to negotiating Rugby League's TV deal with Fox and Channel 9, kind of taking us behind the curtain of how it works. Like, selling the game to TV broadcasters is a pretty weighty part of the job, I'd imagine. You know, can you take us behind the curtain of a TV rights deal or something similar? You know, what's it like dealing with the alphas of Fox Sports and your great mates at Channel 7? And if I was sitting opposite you in a negotiation, like, what sort of combatant would I find in Nick Hockley?
I think you'd find someone who, well, firstly, we're all incentivized in the same direction. You know, we're all incentivized to grow the game. The more people that are watching on TV, the better for cricket, and the better are, you know, the better entertainment we put on, the more people are watching. So, I mean, I've inherited these the broadcast deals. I think the relationship's massively important. You know, for me, it's making sure that they've got a real seat at the table and have a say, because they actually know what works. You know, they're in the entertainment game, much broader than cricket, much broader than sport. you know, I'm enjoying learning from them what's important to them, because if we can't deliver something that's important for them, it's not gonna derive the value. So what hopefully they see is someone who really understands value and what commercial value is. I mean, I very much spent the last 15 years in the commercial side of sport, and you know, through that I've been very focused on building value, generating revenue to deliver great sporting events. And so they'll come across someone who wants to make sure that they're getting value for money, and we're delivering real value.
Just on that, I know you keep mentioning the global entertainment business of cricket, which I accept that premise as well. How and media and changing media. I mean, look at whatever this idiotic thing is that we do. Like, how seriously are you taking big tech streamers? You know, you guys did a documentary with Amazon. Say you guys, Cricket Australia did a documentary with Amazon. I'm sure that had strategic purpose to it. You don't have to respond to that. And, you know, they hold now small rights for New Zealand matches into India. They're making small steps into that space. There's Google, there's Disney, Facebook, DAZN over in the UK. You know, is it a matter of when, not if, these players become future rights holders in cricket and sports generally?
Well, I think they already are becoming sports rights holders. You know, Amazon Prime have now taken the swimming. So I think the barriers to entry are lowering. I think for us, it's about building relationships more broadly. You know, I think the test documentary was an amazing success on Amazon Prime. And if you speak to, you know, both our free-to-air and our subscription TV broadcasters here in Australia, they were thrilled with that because it helps build the brand of the game, gives you a bit more of an insight into the players. So I think there's room for a whole range of media, including your fantastic podcast. I just think what we're going to see is we're increasing fragmentation, but also, you know, I think different media is going to have a different role to play. And for us, it's all about building relationships and building a really strong proposition so that we can deliver value to everybody.
We saw just in the last week, Nick, about you know, England and New Zealand, the test match there, and there's a whole conversation going on about England's entire focus is towards the Ashes. Excuse me. So I want to know. So I'm just choking up.
You're just scoffing, thinking about that.
Exactly. So I'm wondering, you know, please speak for your countrymen and tell us why England only care about the Ashes.
Well, I think winning an away Ashes for them is just is the ultimate, and something they found very difficult to do over a long period of time. And I can tell you now, the work that's going on behind the scenes and retaining and winning the Ashes well on home soil is something that we're really singularly focused on. So, you know, I think you've got two sides where you've got a lot of experience. You've got some people maybe coming slightly towards the end of their careers as well. And, you know, it was a very tight series over there last time. I think it's going to be very competitive, and I think it's going to be, after the last series against India, it's going to be compelling viewing. Mm. And I just can't wait.
Mm. I mean, you say a lot of work's going on behind the scenes, and I like to hear that. I feel my loins are girded, you know, hearing that. But Australia's not playing at the moment, so I can only guess that it's just about creating the greenest, fastest wickets of all time at the moment in some kind of climate-controlled environment. I mean, what sort of work is going on behind the scenes to ensure that England do not have any success while here?
It's planning the preparation. You know, we've been starved of Test cricket, but it's a busy run-in, and it's a busy run-in for a range of other formats. So it's... Yeah, how are we competitive in the T20 World Cup, but also how do we make sure that we're balancing those objectives with performing really well in the Ashes, which is the priority. So, and that's the balancing act for everybody at the moment. And then you add in quarantine, you add in all of those additional challenges, and that, you know, I think what's really important is that we're really, really well planned. So now that the guys are back from the IPL safely, they've literally got 2 weeks off, and then it's regroup in Brisbane, and it's basically plot out very, very carefully each of their individual programs so that they're we're in best shape come the summer.
I'm sure you would have noted this from overseas, and there's all sorts of extraneous things that can happen that can throw a team off its course beyond any kind of control, preparation and planning. But you would have followed the Ollie Robinson episode over in England. He's been suspended for racist and sexist tweets he published as a teenager. Overnight, as we go to where we've seen UK Culture Secretary Oliver Dowden and Prime Minister Boris Johnson condemning the ECB's action as over the top. There's probably pretty similar political and cultural forces that would be at play in Australia around these kinds of issues as well. As CEO, how would you have dealt with this were it an Australian player at the centre of the episode?
Yeah, I don't know too much of the ins and outs of that. I do know, I mean, we had some experiences over the summer which just show you actually how important, influential, you know, the platform we have and how respect and is just mission critical, and how people looked up to the behaviour of everyone involved in elite sport. You know, I'm thinking, obviously, you know, there was speculation around the Sydney test, around those elements, which equally we had there's some strong views in the summer around how we refer to 26th of January and that debate. So, I haven't seen the UK Prime Minister's comments. But what it just emphasises is we're in a, you know, people really care. We're in a position of influence, and we need to be taking leadership on matters of inclusion, respect, and I actually think cricket. We've just got an amazing opportunity to bring communities together, and certainly something I feel very passionate about. You know, I think about the makeup of that team at West Bromwich Dartmouth. You know, we had I would say probably 2/3 of the side South Asian heritage, and you know, one of the things that I'm really keen to see is that Australian cricket is truly representative of modern multicultural Australian society. And that we all treat each other with respect.
I think it's a great place to finish it, Nick. Thanks so much for submitting yourself to us and whatever this is. And thank you for your kind comments about us being part of the media ecosystem that includes Amazon and Channel 7 and stuff like that. You're laughing as you said that. But thanks so much, mate. All the best in the role. Thanks in advance for delivering a crushing victory in the Ashes.
Good stuff. Cheers, guys.